The makers of Campbell Soup present The Campbell Playhouse. Orson Welles, producer.
Good evening. This is Orson Welles. We bring you tonight a story by one of America's most successful writers in recent years, Kenneth Roberts. The title, Rabble in Arms. Our guest, Miss Frances D., one of the real actresses among Hollywood's younger stars, and an old friend of yours in the Campbell Playhouse. But before Rabble in Arms, here's Ernest Chappell with some new thoughts on an old kitchen custom. Mr. Chappell?
Thank you, Orson Welles. And ladies and gentlemen, that kitchen custom is an old one, one of the oldest on record. It's the making and the enjoying of vegetable soup. Certainly, many, many years before cookbooks were ever heard of, women were taking good meat and vegetables and combining them in a hearty, substantial soup. And so, in offering their vegetable soup, Campbell's have always recognized the friendly competition of the home soup kettle. They've known that time-saving and trouble-saving in themselves, though important, would never alone sell Campbell's vegetable soup to conscientious wives and mothers. They've known that to have Campbell's vegetable soup accepted at the family table year in and year out by good home cooks, it must compare in fine flavor and good nourishment with the best vegetable soup ever made at home. If you've tried it, then you know that's the kind of vegetable soup Campbell's make. Your first taste tells you they've taken fine beef and simmered it down till the stock is rich and rugged and full-flavored. And in this beef stock, you enjoy the flavor of the 15 different garden vegetables Campbell's use. With a vegetable soup as fine and as wholesome as this waiting at the grocer's, it's no wonder that women everywhere have given up making vegetable soup and turned to Campbell's. If you haven't tried it, won't you do so? If you will, I'm convinced that in your home, too, you'll say, Campbell's is the vegetable soup for us. And now, Orson Welles.
In June 1778, Benedict Arnold was placed by General Washington in command of Philadelphia. Early in February of the next year, the Executive Council of Pennsylvania, presided over by Joseph Reed, one of Arnold's most persistent enemies, presented to Congress 8 charges of misconduct against him. In April, Congress, through throwing out 4 charges, referred the 4 to a court-martial. And despite Arnold's demand for a speedy trial, it was December before the court was convened. It was probably during this period of vexatious delay that Arnold, always sensitive and now incited by a keen sense of injustice, entered into a secret correspondence with Sir Henry Clinton with a view of joining the British service. On January 26th, the court, before which Arnold had ably argued his own case, rendered its verdict, practically acquitting him of all intentional wrong, but directing Washington to reprimand him for 2 trivial offenses. Arnold, who had expected absolute acquittal, was inflamed with a burning anger that even Washington's kindly reprimand, couched almost in words of praise, could not subdue. It was then, apparently, that he first conceived the plan of betraying some important post to the British interests. With this in view, he sought and obtained from Washington command of West Point, the key to the Hudson Valley. Arnold's offers now became more explicit, and in order to perfect the details of the plot, Clinton's adjutant general, Major John Andre, met him near Stony Point on the night of September. On the 23rd, while returning by land, Andre, with incriminating papers, was captured, and the officer to whom he was entrusted unsuspectingly sent information of his capture to Arnold, who was thus enabled to escape to the British lines. Ladies and gentlemen, I have read to you from the Encyclopedia Britannica on the subject of the notorious and celebrated treachery of Benedict Arnold. What follows tonight is a defense of his character and of his career before that treachery. Rabble in Arms by Kenneth Roberts with our guest star, Miss Frances D. Rabble in Arms is a story of the Revolution, of which the author Kenneth Roberts tells us on his opening page that this is no book for those who swear by old wives' fables, holding all Americans brave, all Englishmen honorable, and all Frenchmen gallant. It cannot please such innocents as are convinced that men in public office always set the nation's welfare above their own, nor those that think all soldiers patriots. It will disappoint the credulous who cherish the delusion that patriotism burns high in every breast in the hour of a country's peril. Those who crave such poppycock must turn to fairy tales for undeveloped minds. For we are obliged tonight to deal with facts and write what we conceive to be the truth.
America? Good heavens, why, America's a wilderness. If you go there, you'll be eaten by lions or chased by savages.
But she isn't a wilderness at all. Jack Burgoyne showed it to me on the map. Why, it's like a regatta on the Thames. You go to Quebec, and then you come to the lakes, beautiful lakes. And then to the Hudson River. And before you know it, you're in New York. Aren't you, Lord Germain?
Quite right, my dear. Quite right. It's as safe as walking in Hyde Park.
There, you see.
What about the rebels? The
rebels? Oh, they won't bother you. They'll run like sheep when they see our regulars. I'm sending 1,000 of them over next week under Burgoyne. 2,000 Hessians, 5,000 Indians recruited in Canada. That'll put them in their places. Oh, they're nothing but beggars, you know, officered by shoemakers, butchers, barbers. Imagine our British troops being opposed by rabble. That's all they are, you know, rabble. A rabble in arms.
That's what the English thought of us in 1776. I heard it with my own ears, sitting in the rotunda in Ranelagh Gardens in London. That was many years ago now. My name is Merrill, Captain Peter Merrill of Arundel in Maine. I've sailed my ships out of New England ports these many years now, to South America and the Indies and around the Horn. The things I remember the best are the things that happened to me many years ago when I was still a young man, almost a boy. And those years I spent at the war with my brother Nathaniel, the war of the revolution against England. Now, as it happens, when the war started, I wasn't in America. I was with my brother Nathaniel on my father's business in London. There it was that Nathaniel first met that woman, Marie de Sabrevois, and fell under her spell. And there it was that I heard what those English lords and ladies thought of us Americans. A rabble, they called us. A rabble in arms.
Here, sir.
Ebenezer Plant.
Here.
Jeremiah Small.
Come in, I'm coming.
Tom Bigfoot. You here, Tom?
I'm here, Steve.
Good. Doc Means.
Sitting on a rum barrel.
Peter. Peter or Nathaniel Merrill.
Yeah.
You're right here, Mr. Nason.
All right, I guess that makes up the whole company. Cap Huff.
Yep, Mr. Nason.
As quartermaster of this detachment, you'll kindly inform the men of their requirements.
Very good, sir. Each man enlisted for scout duty with the Continental Army expected to serve for a period of 3 years and required to equip himself and be constantly provided with good firearm, ramrod, worm, priming wire, brush, bayonet, scabbard, belt, cutting sword, tomahawk, or hatchet, pouch containing cartridge box for 15 rounds, 100 buckshot, tow for wadding, 1 pound powder, 40 balls to fit firearm, knapsack, blanket, canteen or wooden bottle, capacity 1 quart, provision for 3 days.
All right. All right, men. You've heard what your requirements are as specified by the American Congress now assembled in Philadelphia. They haven't supplied you with a blessed one of these things. They don't have nothing to do with it. Now then, get your packs on. We've got a long way to go, and we're going fast. I want no stopping anywhere along the way to rest, nor to argue, nor to steal. And we want no stragglers, neither women nor boys. We've got to go fast and alone. Squad, attention! Forward! March! Keep in step! Keep in step!
Rabble in arms, they called us. Well, they weren't so far wrong at that. That's just about what we looked like on that June morning 3 months later, with all our folks gathered around to see us go. Barely 24 of us in our homespun suits. No uniforms, no stores, no guns for the half of us, and no two alike. Just where we were going, none of us knew. Nor for how long we'd be gone. Nor what we'd do once we got there. On the morning of the sixth day, we reached the Richelieu River. The next day, going upstream in hired bateau, we passed some provision boats going north from Lake Champlain. The next day, our eighth, we reached St. John.
Hello!
Who are you?
Scouts from the state of Maine! Steve Nason, Commander!
Keep away from here!
Hey! Hey, what are you talking about?
Provided with rations.
We've got 280
What's happened to your supplies?
About a halfway down to Philadelphia. Hold them up. Congressmen, they call themselves.
About a halfway.
Say, brother, you better be careful how you talk about Congress. There's a law against it.
We'll have enough here a couple hours before you start telling us how to talk about Congress. And when you see the generals that stand up here.
Oh, women. That's what they are.
I don't know what general you're talking about, mister. But I'll tell you right now, Congress sent up Benedict Arnold, and there ain't a better officer alive.
Hey, Benedict Arnold. Arnold, that's different. Even if I am from Pennsylvania, why admit Arnold's the best officer up here?
Yeah, maybe that's why Congress relieved him of his command.
You mean Arnold ain't running things up here no more?
Not since General Wooster took over.
I've got orders to get these men through to General Arnold. I'm going to get it done. But if we come ashore here, we have to land back at peace and dodge around you.
Oh, well, if you're right there on catching the smallpox and starving to death, that's all right with me.
Yep, everything's in the mess anyway. I guess you won't make it much worse.
Come ahead. You go ahead.
I tell you, Mr. Nason, it's no use.
I've tried everywhere.
They say us New Englanders is tight. These here French farmers here around St. John.
They won't even
sell you. There's something else again.
They won't even sell you nothing for money.
Since that bear retreat from Quebec, the French won't touch Congress money.
That's
true. Well, do you blame them?
No, sir, I don't.
No, it's not worth the paper it's printed on.
That's right.
I've got an idea, Mr. Nason.
You, Nathaniel? What is it?
I've got a little hard money, Mr. Nason. An English sovereign I saved from London.
Hey, you never showed me.
I think if I go up to those farmers across the river, I can pick up enough pork and cornmeal with that to get us to Montreal. I'll start now if you want me to.
Good. The sooner the better. Buy what you can and get back here with it as soon as possible.
Mr. Nason.
Yes, Peter?
I'll go with him, Mr. Nason. I've got some hard money, too, and I can speak a little French. I'll go with him. Anyway, for bargaining, two is better than one.
Peter, we'd have a much better chance to find food if we'd go separately.
No, I'll go with you, Antonio.
I can get along myself, Peter.
Now, I've been watching you.
Hmm?
I know what's in your mind. Before you left London, that Frenchwoman, the one you were seeing all the time, Marie de
Sabrefois. What about her?
She gave you a letter to deliver up here in Canada, didn't she? Didn't she?
Well, what of it?
Well, I've an idea that St. John's here is where you're to deliver that letter.
What if it is?
I think your mind is on that letter now more than it is on your duty. Which is to get food so our detachment can get through to Montreal.
I know our business as well as you.
Where does she live, this niece of hers?
She lives in the big house with a cross, the other side of the river.
Oh. So that's why you were so anxious to get away alone across the river.
Well, then what of it? What's wrong in such a note?
Nathaniel, I'm not letting you get into trouble here in St. John's or anywhere else. If anybody wants to know where you've been in this town and who you've seen, I propose to be able to tell them. But if you want to deliver your letter, hurry up about it, because I'm going with you.
What is it? What do you want?
Is Ellen Phipps here? Ellen Phipps. I have a letter for her, from her aunt, from Madame de Sabrevois.
Ellen! Ellen!
Oui, Madame Saint-Ange.
Sit down, my dear. Monsieur, from where did you bring this letter?
From London. We were in London until the end of March. I met Marie, Madame Sabrevois, there.
Yes, of course. She is the guardian of this child. Read the letter, Ellen. Read it out loud for these gentlemen.
My darling Ellen, I send you my love by a kind gentleman who may see you before I do. I shall come to you as soon as I return. Pray assure the good Madame Saint-Ange.
That is my name, Monsieur. Madame Saint-Ange.
That all goes well here, but that I long to see you once more. Never again to leave you. Meantime, I send you 8,000 kisses. Your loving aunt, Marie de Sabrevois.
Ah, so kind she is. Always so good and kind.
She said in her letter she'd come here to St. John's when she returned. Do you know when that will be?
I do not know.
You've had no news of her?
This is the first news in many months.
I'd like to leave a message for her. Could I write it here?
But of course, monsieur.
There is no time to make a wish.
I won't be a minute.
This way, monsieur. And you, Elaine, you will entertain this gentleman until we return.
Yes, madame. Sit down, monsieur, before the fire. You must be tired and cold. Isn't that better?
Thank you. Thank you kindly, miss.
You're with the army, are you not?
Yeah, I'm afraid so.
Something I know so little about, this terrible war. We hear sad tales here and at the convent.
What sort of tales?
About those poor Americans without food and without medicines. Everyone says it's hopeless what they're trying to do.
Hopeless?
That's what they say, but of course I know nothing about such things. I only hope they can return safely to their homes and to those who love them.
How old are you?
17. Why do you ask?
I have a sister back home. She's your age. But her hair is black and straight.
Oh, my. If I had straight hair, then it wouldn't tangle. There'd be no need to cut it off like this. I have no sister. No brother either, for that matter.
Where's your mother?
She died 5 years ago. Since then, I've had nobody. Nobody except my Aunt Marie.
Madame de Sablevoix?
Yes, the one whose letter you brought me. She placed me in the same convent to which she went when she was a young lady in Quebec. The nuns were very sweet to me. Very kind, like mothers almost.
So you missed the convent?
Well, it was my only home. It's possible to be homesick even for a convent if you have no other home.
Why did your aunt take you from the convent and send you down here in wartime?
I don't know. I think she thought it was an opportunity being allowed to come with the sisters to work among these poor people here at St. John's.
Your aunt's an American, isn't she?
Oh, she wouldn't like to hear you say that. My aunt's the sister of a great French officer.
Oh.
He was killed last year by the Americans.
You'll be sure to give it to her.
I will.
Well, thank you. All right, Peter, I'm ready.
Did Elaine entertain you, monsieur, while we were gone?
Yes, she was most kind. We spoke of her family.
Her family? But she does not remember too much about it. She was very young.
Nevertheless, it was most interesting. Bye, madame.
Goodbye, monsieur.
And thank you again.
It is nothing, monsieur. I hope you will have a pleasant journey to Montreal. The two of you.
Bye, Ellen.
Goodbye.
Nathaniel, something strange about that place. And that girl. And that letter. Did you notice anything strange about that letter?
No. It was a letter from an aunt to her niece that she's fond of. She was sending her love, that's all.
No wonder that is all. Did you notice anything strange about the number of kisses she sent?
No, of course not. Oh,
Peter, you're talking nonsense. She sent 8,000 kisses. Do you remember what Lord Germain said that evening at Ranelagh? He said 2,000 Hessians, 1,000 regulars, and 5,000 Indians. That makes 8,000. The next day, we were in Montreal. On every street were American soldiers, recognizable as soldiers only because they had bayonets and scabbards, most of them, or dented kettles banging against their hips, or the tattered remains of blankets made fast to their shoulders. But for that, I would have taken them for beggars. They were the raggedest men I'd ever seen anywhere. Shoeless, stockingless, many of them, with breeches seemingly made of dirty rags and ribbons. And they were searching for food, every one of them. When we asked them where their companies were, they sometimes said they were hunting them or that their enlistments had expired and they were trying to get home, though most of them, I think, were lying. When we went on, they slunk away, peering into alleys and up at windows like hungry cats. We came to the Chateau Ramezay, Arnold's headquarters.
General Arnold?
Well, Nathan, you've been away long enough. I trust the results have justified your little vacation. Is this all you got, one man? Don't tell me this is the sole result of 2 months' holiday. Who is this man?
General, this here is Captain Peter Merrill.
Captain? Captain of what?
The Brig Orestes, sir, of Arundel, 188 tons.
Mason?
He's all right, General. Known him for years, him and his brother Nathaniel.
Take your word for it. When were you in St. John's?
Last night.
Who was there? General Sullivan come through with a new regiment?
No, sir, but we had news of them. They were just leaving Albany on their way up. There wasn't anybody in St. John's except two lieutenants and nearly 300 men down with the smallpox.
Smallpox. Smallpox. If we could fill our haversacks and cartridge boxes with smallpox, we could whip the world. Well, in a mess. We've got an army, thanks to General Washington, but Thanks to Congress, it's got nothing to eat, nothing to wear, nothing to put in its guns. Men desert by the score. They say they've got to get their crops in. Here's a letter from 40 officers begging leave to resign their commissions and go home. The best general we've got for this country outside of Washington, of course, is Schuyler. I asked Congress to send Schuyler up here to take command, but he was the best man for the place, so, of course, Congress sent him elsewhere.
Is there anything we can do now, General?
Yes, there is. Captain Merrill, you came as a scout, but you're a shipman. I want you and Huff here to go down to St. John's. Start tomorrow. There's a half-finished schooner there. Finish it. Then dismantle it and hold it in readiness to move south. We'll need it on the lakes if we ever have to retreat.
Very well, sir.
Nathan, you come back in the morning with the rest of your men. I'll have orders for you, too.
Yes, sir.
And you pardon me now. I've got letters to write. Letters to Congress. Letters to commissioners. Letters to tradesmen. I got into this war to fight. Now all I do is write letters. Good night, gentlemen. Well, what are you waiting for?
I was going to ask you, General. My men haven't eaten today.
Oh, you haven't, eh? Well, there's nothing but dried peas to be had around here. If you're hungry, I can give you an order for some of them. Dried peas. It's as good a diet as any other on which to die for your country.
I'd been in St. John's 2 days when the new troops from Albany began to arrive on their way north. The new troops. 4 battalions of Pennsylvanians under General Sullivan in their bright new uniforms. Every man's musket tipped with a bayonet. And each soldier's hair properly clubbed and neatly tied, just so. I found myself wishing that Nathaniel could be with me to see these fine regiments. And it dawned on me that I might never have had such a wish unless, in my heart, there still remained certain doubts about him. And I began to think of that letter and of that woman, Marie de Sabrevoir.
Yes, what is it? What do you want?
Madame.
Oh, it's you, the American.
Yes, madame. Can I see Miss Ellen, please?
But I do not understand. Have you not seen your brother lately? I mean...
No, madame. General Arnold detailed him to scout duty on the St. Lawrence. I haven't seen my brother for some days.
Oh, then that explains everything. Elaine is quite fond of your brother, you know. Quite fond. He stopped by here 2 days ago.
My brother was here 2 days ago?
Oh, yes.
Where is he now?
He is gone. I am surprised you did not know. And Elaine, too.
Ellen?
Why, yes. He had a note with him for Madame de Sabrevoir in Quebec.
Madame de Sabrevoir is in Quebec?
Yes. She has arrived from England some days ago. She was afraid from something she had heard that there was to be fighting in these parts. So she sent Elaine to Albany.
What? Alone?
No, no, no. Your brother was kind enough to take Elaine to Albany.
What?
Personally. Why, Mr. Merrill, what is it? You look so surprised and so disapproving.
I do disapprove. My brother's in the American army and we're at war. If this gets known...
Well, they have been barely 2 days on the road. If you hurry after them, it is just possible that you will be able to catch up with them. If you are very lucky...
It was 2 weeks before I saw them, Ellen and my brother Nathaniel. And in that time, a heap of things had happened, things that you can read about today in the history books. How Sullivan's troops, those beautiful regiments that went up the river so full of hope, landed at Trois-Rivières. How their Indian guides stripped them and led them first into one swamp and then into another. How the English came up from nowhere and caught them by surprise. That's the thing nobody's ever been able to understand, how the English knew they were coming. But they did somehow, and burned their boats and then shot them to pieces while they struggled in the swamps. I saw them come down the river. Sullivan's army, naked and starved and sick. Of the army that had gone up that river 10 days before, less than half was alive. And if it hadn't been for General Arnold and what he did then, I doubt if a single man of them would have escaped. Racing down from Montreal, cutting his way through the whole English army with a handful of men, it was he who planned the retreat. He alone who made it possible. I tell you, he was a great man. The best leader and the greatest general and the finest brains in the whole Continental Army. Except maybe for General Washington. That he trusted me and that I had some small share in his work is something I'm prouder of than anything that ever happened in my whole life. Or since.
Captain Peter Merrill at Crown Point from Brigadier General Arnold in command of the American Naval Forces on Lake Champlain. I hereby order to assemble ship's timbers at the southern tip of the lake at once. Find a sawmill at Skeensboro. Start getting more timbers, no loss of time. lay down keels for 10 row galleys. If we can get enough men, we'll build a 38-gun ship, a frigate, then she'll kick up a dust. Everything depends on speed. Benedict Arnold, Brigadier General.
Hello, Peter.
Nathaniel.
Why, what's the matter? Aren't you glad to see me?
What are you doing here at Skinsborough?
Why, I...
Nathaniel, where have you been? Did you go to Albany?
Albany?
I heard you were on your way there.
Is there anything so wrong about that?
While other men get killed for that country, you go running pretty ladies' errands in Albany.
Don't talk to me like that, Peter.
Oh, that's because you're a child.
I'll show you where I'm going now.
Peter? Nathaniel?
Wait. Helen?
You see, Nathaniel, I told you your brother would be angry. It's all my fault. Perhaps if you let me explain, Captain Peter. Only you might say how do you do to me first.
How do you do, Miss Helen?
That's better. Now I'll tell you everything, and you'll find it very simple. My aunt, Madame de Sabrevoix, wished me to go to Albany. She'd intended to take me there herself. And suddenly she became ill and couldn't go. She was very anxious for me not to delay, so she chose your brother as my escort.
My brother had no right to absent himself from duty.
Peter.
Well, perhaps that's why he was not very gallant. I never did see a gentleman less anxious to accompany a lady.
But I thought I understood that Nathaniel...
Oh, yes. Yes, he's very devoted. But it's the aunt he loves, not the niece at all. And the aunt is still up in Canada.
Oh.
Why do you look so strangely, Captain Peter? Is anything the matter?
No, no, no. Go on.
So here's poor Nathaniel with a young lady on his hands. See how miserable he looks? He thinks it'll be 2 days, and already it's nearly 2 weeks. And here we are, still at the end of the lake, and no carriages, no horses, no means to take me to Albany. It's very sad, don't you think?
If I'd known that you were here when General Arnold was going down, I'd have sent you with him.
With Arnold?
Oh, no, I wouldn't go with him. What? I've heard about him, an awful man, a murderer.
Ellen,
a ruffian who gives orders to kill women and children.
He's nothing of the sort. Let me tell you that General Arnold is one of
Peter, what's the good of trying to stand up for Arnold after what's happened?
After what's happened? What? You mean after what he did to save our troops in Canada?
You know he's no fit man to hold high rank in the American army. Everybody knows he's going to be arrested for what he's done.
Arrested?
Well, he certainly won't be allowed to hold a command. Not after Congress hears what he's done.
Nathaniel, what are you talking about? What is this nonsense?
Nonsense? Well, it's common knowledge.
No, it's not.
Well?
It's not common knowledge.
Well, Peter, everybody...
What do you mean by saying when Congress knows what he's done?
I mean just that, Peter. When Congress learns about the things he stole in Montreal, there'll be trouble. The supplies for the army and the church treasures and the...
Oh, so Congress is going to hear that Arnold's a thief, is it? Who's it going to learn it from?
How should I know? Somebody's bound to tell.
Who told you?
Why, everybody.
Tell me one.
I don't remember any particular one, but in
Canada, everybody... What you're saying is a lie. Do you understand? It's a lie. And I insist on you telling me who said these things.
I'd rather not discuss it any further.
And I tell you, you must tell me.
Goodbye, Peter. See you later.
Nathaniel. Nathaniel! Come back here! Nathaniel! It's a lie, I tell you!
Captain Peter, if you must get so excited and wave your arms so, you'd better let me take your coat and stitch it for you before it falls off.
Thanks.
Well, let me have it. And that's better. I have a needle and thread. It won't take you long. Sit down and rest.
Miss Ellen, perhaps you can answer a question that's been worrying me about yourself.
You've been worrying about me?
Yes, worrying and wondering, too. I was wondering why your aunt is so anxious to have you go to Albany now, in the middle of this war. Is there anything in particular you're to do there? Anyone you're to see? Have you any letters you have to deliver?
Letters? Why, yes, there was a letter.
From your aunt?
No, it was not from my aunt. It was from a friend of hers in Canada, she said, to a friend in Albany.
Yeah, you have this letter here?
No, only yesterday an officer came through that was riding to Albany. I gave it to him to deliver.
Do you remember who it was addressed to?
No, I do not. I don't remember at all.
I see.
Captain Peter.
Yes, Ellen?
Do you mind if now I ask you something? Something I've been wondering?
No, of course not.
I've been thinking And I'd like to tell you what I was thinking, because I don't wish to be mistaken. See if I'm right. From the first time I met you, Captain Peter, you've now and then had a few thoughts about me, haven't you?
Yes.
Were they kind ones?
Yes.
Well, if you have kind thoughts of me, that means you like me, doesn't it?
Yes.
And that's what I thought, only I want to be sure. Now I wish to tell you something else. The first time you came to the house at St. John's and sat beside me before the fire and told me about your sister, I thought you were very kind, and I've thought a lot about you ever since.
Ellen.
Wait, I'm trying to make you understand something that I feel. There were other questions you asked me the first time you saw me. It seemed to puzzle you what I was doing there at St. John's in time of war.
Yes, yes, it did.
And just now you asked me certain other questions. Questions about my going to Albany.
Yes.
You don't want me to go to Albany, do you? Why?
Well, you see, until I know just why your aunt is sending you to Albany, I'm afraid to have you go there.
Afraid? Afraid something may happen to me?
No, not exactly. Not in the way you mean.
Then what are you afraid of?
Ellen, something you innocently might say or do... It's not easy to say.
Go on, say it. Please say it.
Very well. I'm afraid that without knowing it, you might do something to hurt our cause. The American cause.
I see. I understand now. You think my aunt's a spy. That is what you think, isn't it? That's why you asked me all those ugly questions.
But Ellen, I didn't mean to...
If you suspect her, then you must suspect me, too.
Oh, no,
if
no,
you
Ellen,
can think
of
wickedly of someone so dear to me, you must think me wicked.
Ellen.
No.
Ellen.
No, Captain Peter. You and I can't be friends, and I don't want to see you again, do you hear me? Ever. Ever again.
Brigadier General Benedict Arnold in command of the American naval forces on Lake Champlain. Report from Captain Peter Merrill in charge of fleet construction, Keamsport, New York. 3 schooners, 1 sloop, 6 gondolas, 4 galleys launched and being fitted. We'll be ready for action within 3 weeks.
Captain Peter Merrill, Brigadier General Benedict Arnold. Good work, but English fleet will not wait 3 weeks. Expect entire American fleet ready for action within 10 days.
To Brigadier General Benedict Arnold. Report entire American fleet now fitted, awaiting orders.
Captain Peter Merrill, October 12, 1776. General orders to the fleet. All ships will proceed to anchorage at Valcour Island in the northern section of Lake Champlain. Immediately and without delay. Well, gentlemen, are we all aboard?
Thatcher, the Washington galley.
Present.
Warner, the Trumbull galley. Present. Merrill, Congress galley. Davis.
Present.
Lee Galley, Dickinson, the Enterprise.
Present.
Condello, Captains. Grant of the Connecticut.
Present.
Honor of the Specify.
Present.
Simmons, the Providence.
Present.
Reed of the New York.
Present.
Rice of the Philadelphia.
Present.
Grimes of New Jersey.
Present.
Sumner of the Boston.
Present.
All right, gentlemen. Word has just reached me from the patrol boat Revenge. An hour ago, the British fleet passed Cumberland Head. By now, they're abreast of us on the far side of the island. It's what I expected and figured on. They haven't observed proper precaution. They've overrated themselves. They haven't kept proper watch. So they're going by it. Now, gentlemen... Either we can let them go or we can engage them. If we fight now, we fight against a fleet almost twice our own size. But we fight in our own position and at our own time. The opportunity may not present itself again. Gentlemen, what's to be done? Hurry, gentlemen, they're going by.
What's your opinion, General?
I don't have my opinion fast enough. What's yours?
If we fight them here and we're caught, we'll never get away. I've got a full-rigged ship that can outshoot anything we've got. On the lake, if we're sinking, we'll have a chance to haul out. If we fight here, we're caught.
You want to fight him on a retreat, Mr. Davis.
Well, isn't it better to save some ship than not save any?
That's true enough.
I agree with that.
All right, that's what some of you think, and here's what I think. The object of this fleet isn't to save itself. The chief thing is to keep the British from getting to Ticonderoga and the Hudson in this campaign. To save the lake from them, for this year at least. What happens to us doesn't matter, so long as we keep them where we are. If luck's against us, which I trust under God it won't be, then we can talk of retreat, but not till then. My opinion. Let them come, by God. Let them stick their heads into this bottleneck. They'll never board us. They can't do it. They've got to stay out in front of us. Swap shot for shot with us. If our men could only shoot us, they'd send us a tenth part of what we needed. Those mercenary rats on the seaboard. They'd put all their sailors and all their money into privateers so there's nothing left for the defense of their country. We could fight off twice our strength in ships and guns. And yes, we can do it now. Now, now, right here on this anchorage. We can fight him all day, and with luck, we can beat him off. If we can't, we'll find a way of delaying him again. Delaying him and delaying him till we save the lake. Gentlemen, I say fight him here and fight him now. What have you got to say?
It appears we're all willing, General.
Thank you. Then if there's no objection...
Objections? Well, good grief, General. There ain't time to think of any.
Counsel dismissed.
General, what's that?
Gunfire.
I had an idea. You'd agree with me, gentlemen. 10 minutes ago, I gave orders for our patrol boat to engage the enemy. The Battle of Lake Champlain has begun. You ready, Mr. Gunner?
Ready, sir.
Fire!
Campbell Playhouse presentation of Rabble in Arms, starring Francis Dee and Orson Welles in the role of Benedict Arnold. This is the Columbia Broadcasting System. This is Ernest Chappell, ladies and gentlemen, welcoming you back to the Campbell Playhouse. In a moment, we shall resume our presentation of Rabble in Arms. But first, I'd like to remind you that it wasn't really so very long ago that women had to make their own soup. It was usually a long and tedious task. But they knew that good soup is something that families enjoy having regularly. So they devoted long kitchen hours each week to tending the soup kettle. But then a change came. A change that has been welcomed in countless homes. One by one, women tried Campbell's soups and compared them with their own. And they knew when they tasted them that these soups must have been made in the true home way. They saw how much the family enjoyed their fine flavor. And thoughtful husbands said to wives, "With all you've got to do, I wouldn't spend time anymore making soup. Not when you can buy good soup like this." So tonight I'd like to ask you, are you still making soup at your house? If so, I'm sure it must be because you haven't tried Campbell's soups. Won't you do that? If you will, I believe your family will urge you, too, to give up making soup and serve Campbell's soups for their convenience and fine flavor. And now we resume our Campbell Playhouse presentation of Rabble in Arms, starring Orson Welles and Francis Dee.
Didn't know it then, or in the hours that followed. But on what we were doing that day on Lake Champlain, with the help of Arnold's grim determination, depended the life of the revolution, and the very existence of what we know as freedom. If Arnold had failed us, or if we had failed him that day on Valcour Island, I think that no American that hears these words would be in the position of life in which he finds himself today. What we set out to do was achieved. We delayed the English. We delayed them till winter came. We delayed them so that for 9 months at least, Ticonderoga and Albany and the Hudson Valley were saved. And what was Arnold's reward? They said of him that he lost the battle. They said of him that he left his men to drown. They called him down to Washington and had him court-martialed by a lot of small, mean men. And by the time they exonerated him, they put Gates and three more incompetent, intriguing generals over his head. For me, too, that was a sad winter. Nathaniel was gone. Drowned or taken prisoner in the sinking of the Royal Savage. And Ellen. Ellen was gone, too. When I returned to Skeensborough, she'd vanished. Whether to Albany or to the north among the enemy troops, I couldn't discover. And then in the spring came the fall of Ticonderoga and the English advanced toward the Hudson Valley. There were times when the enemy camps were not more than a mile or two apart. In July, General Arnold returned to the army.
Peter Merrill?
Yes, sir.
Come in. I want to talk to you.
It's good to see you back, General.
Thanks. Good to be among men again after 6 months around politicians and congressmen. Merrill, there's something I want to ask you.
Yes, General.
What's happened to your brother, Nathaniel?
I don't know, sir. He was on the Royal Savage, as you know, when she sank.
Yes, I know.
I've no idea, sir, if he's alive or dead.
You're not lying, are you, Merrill, to save your brother?
Yes, sir. I don't understand.
Well, I seem to know a bit more about him than you do. I may have been out of service for a while, but my sources of information have continued. See, I know that your brother is alive.
Yes, sir.
I also know that at this moment he's in the British camp.
You mean, sir?
Have you ever heard of a lady called Madame de Sabrevoir?
Yes, I have,
sir. It was an unlucky day for your brother when he became infatuated with that lady.
Well, you know about
her. I know that Marie de Sabrevoir is the most successful English spy on this continent. She's the one who sent information to Congress that General Schuyler deserted his troops and that I stole money which was to be used for supplies. I have heard her thank for my court-martial. I also know that Marie de Sabrevoir was the one who gave Congress false information that General Burgoyne was not marching down the Hudson, that sailed to New York from Quebec.
That's why St. Clair was left at Ticonderoga with only 3,500 men. That's why we left it without firing a shot.
I promise you, sir, my brother had nothing to do with that. I swear
I'm not saying that he does, still. Still, you wouldn't like it said that your brother contributed to the downfall of his country, would you?
What can I do, sir?
Perfume, boy. I happen to know that General Burgoyne came down from Canada 3 days ago. With him in the English camp are this lady and your brother.
Nathaniel?
Men have been known to get from one camp to the other in the dark, Mr. Merrill. It's not easy, but it's been done. Any day now, the English will attack us. Then it'll be too late. So, your last chance, save your brother. That's all, Mr. Merrill. I've got work to do.
Thank you, General. And good night.
Good night.
Password.
Ticonderoga.
Pass. Halt! Who's there? Password!
Ticonderoga.
Pass.
Nathaniel! Nathaniel! Peter, what are you doing?
Hiding in that pit waiting for you to come by.
You must be mad coming into the English camp like this.
Oh, getting in isn't hard. It's getting back. Nathaniel, I have to see you.
First of all, they'll shoot you if they catch you.
Oh, they won't catch me. Any office, Peter? How is it if you're a prisoner, you're here at liberty?
Oh, I haven't joined the British, if that's what you're worried about. Hmm? And I'm not a prisoner on parole, either, thanks to Marie's great kindness.
Marie?
Madame de Sablevoix. Everyone's been very good to me, thanks to her. I'm treated as a non-combatant. Officially, I'm a guest of General Burgoyne.
Why? You a guest of General Burgoyne? Where did you spend the winter?
Quebec.
In the hospital?
No. Marie nursed me.
Oh. I see.
She has a lot of power here on the English side. She and General Burgoyne...
Yes, I know. I suppose you've seen General Burgoyne and talked with him, eh?
Oh, yes. Only last week he offered to let Marie and Ellen travel south with the army.
Ellen, too?
And so Marie persuaded him to let me go along as well. Oh, believe me, Peter, I've done nothing wrong or disloyal.
Yes, Nathaniel, I believe you. But there's one very bad side to being the guest of the English, as I see it. Anybody who finds out about it is liable to misunderstand your position.
Who's going to misunderstand it? I haven't been able to write home. Nobody knows whether I'm dead or alive. After Burgoyne marches down the Hudson, there won't be anyone left whose wrong opinion makes any difference.
Yes, but suppose Burgoyne doesn't.
Doesn't what?
Doesn't march down the Hudson.
Peter, that's what I'm trying to tell you. The war's over. We've lost.
Nothing's over until the last gun's fired. Nathaniel, now listen to me. If we stop now, we're stopping before we have to. Arnold hasn't stopped in spite of the way he's been treated. I tell you, we wouldn't either of us feel right ever, I don't believe, if we stop before we've tried everything.
What is there to try?
I want you to come with me. Now, Nathaniel. Tonight. Back to your own people.
There's no way. There's no way.
Yes, yes, there is. You remember that letter of Ellen's? The one that was to be delivered in Albany? Now, this winter, quite by accident, I met the officer to whom you gave that letter. Well, you know what was in it?
It was a letter from Marie to a friend in Albany.
No, it wasn't. In that letter were the names of 200 Albany Tories. Tories that could be counted on to join the British army if it ever got as far as Albany. Now, that letter is now in General Arnold's possession. Now, listen. You go to your friend, Marie de Sablevoix, and tell her this. If we reach the American army safely before dawn tomorrow, it'll go no farther. If we don't, I wouldn't give a dollar for the lives of all 200. Go on. Hurry. I'll wait for you here.
Peter.
Who is it?
It's me. Ellen. Nathaniel will be here in a moment with the safe conduct from General Burgoyne.
But I'd
have come before, but I knew she was watching
Ellen,
me.
Ellen, you shouldn't be here.
Oh, I knew you'd come back one day, Peter. When Nathaniel came to my aunt's tent just now, I knew then that you were here. I came just as soon as
but
I could.
It's not safe for you here. You must go back, Ellen.
I had to see you. The last time I saw you, I behaved very badly. I'm sorry.
No, it was my fault. I shouldn't have
told. No, Peter. You were right. You were right about my aunt. She's what you said she was. I know that now, and worse. She has been kind to me always.
Oh, Ellen, she used you. You loved and trusted her, and she took advantage of
it. I know that too now. That's why I won't stay here any longer, or among people who fight you and your country, Peter. I want to go into the colonies, into your colonies. I want to leave here tonight.
Yes, but Ellen, where would you go in the colonies? You haven't any relatives, have you, on this side?
No, I have no one. No one except you, Peter.
Me?
You... Remember at Gainsborough, Peter, you told me that you felt kindly about me, and I told you that I felt how I felt about you. What I didn't tell you, Peter, is that from the first day I saw you, from the first day you came and sat beside me by the fire at St. John's and talked to me, I've thought always of you, only of you.
Ellen. Ellen.
Oh, Peter, I love you. I love you.
Days later, the English attacked, Burgoyne moving south and east down the Hudson Valley, trying to break through to the sea. That he didn't break through that day, that the war of the American Revolution was not ended there and then, was due to one man, and one man alone, Benedict Arnold. I was there, and I know. All his life, Arnold was a performer of prodigies, a man who saw how to do and freely risked his life to do what other men said could not be done. Yet when it was all over, and the English were stopped, Arnold, his horse shot dead under him, a bullet in his leg, and deprived once more of his command, was lying in the hospital.
Charlotte! Influence! And a doctor among you knows what he's doing and how he does it. Why don't you learn your trade so you don't have to spend half your life guessing, quacks! Quacks, that's what you are! Get out!
The general,
get out!
Well, our turn now.
Peter, you go in. Ellen and I'll stay out here.
No, we'll all go in. It's better to face a man when he's angry. His anger can't last forever, and it grows less, and then he becomes kind. Go on, Peter, knock.
All right.
Stay out, don't come in here. Who the blazes is it?
Peter Merrill, sir.
Merrill, come on in. Oh, you finally came to see me, eh?
I didn't know you were here, General, until this morning. Where were you hit, sir?
In the leg, and I wish it had been my heart. If it hadn't been for that bullet, I'd have driven Burgoyne into the sea.
I know you would, sir.
Oh, Gates, that dressmaker's dummy, will let him get away, and we'll have to start all over again. Only this time, maybe I won't be there. Well, what is it, Mr. Merrill? Who are these people?
This is Ellen Phipps, sir.
Sit down, Miss Phipps. You'll excuse this disarray, ma'am. It's not often we find such gems of loveliness in this part of the world.
And this is my brother, Nathaniel.
So this is Nathaniel, and...
Yes, sir.
So he was not a prisoner. Nathaniel Merrill remained within the British lines during an entire campaign. What's his excuse for that?
I'll not make excuses for himself.
Well, sir...
And he'll make none for himself. My brother believed what was told him by the woman he loved. He believed that the cause of the colonies was hopeless, and that the sooner the American people knew it and stopped fighting, the better it would be for them.
Mm-hmm. You believe that?
Yes.
And yet last night you returned to the American camp. You fought in today's battle.
I wanted to be with my own people, my brother. If he was beaten, I wanted to be beaten too.
Mm. Sir, Nathaniel made a mistake. A terrible mistake. He knows that now. Sir, if he's given a chance, he's as valuable a man as you can find anywhere. Valuable to you and to the American cause.
That's what you think, is it?
I know it. I was never so sure of anything in my life.
What do you think, miss?
I agree with Peter, General Arnold.
You hear what they say, Nathaniel. Now on, do you think we can count on you?
I do, sir.
Very well, then. Blasted leg. Give me that field desk, somebody. Get that field desk, miss. Open it up and hold it so I can write on it. That's it, thank you. I have the impression, ma'am, that you're in love with Nathaniel Merrill. Or am I mistaken?
I care for him very much. And his brother.
His brother, did you say?
Yes, sir.
His brother? Perhaps he has more than one. Which of his brothers do you mean? Not this one here, I trust. I'm sure you could never mean Captain Peter Merrill. That's impossible, of course. Impossible.
There's nothing impossible about it, General Arnold.
Hmm?
If I didn't care for Peter, that would be impossible.
Oh. Captain Peter Merrill. You're a ladies' man, after all. I'm disappointed in you. Well, here you are. How'll this do? Valcour Island, October 11th, 1776. The day we fought the English on Lake Champlain. Nathaniel Merrill, scout, Captain Nason's company of scouts, is ordered on detached duty at his own discretion
Until this order is rescinded, signed Benedict Arnold, Brigadier General. Order rescinded, what's the date today?
October 18th,
sir. Order rescinded, October 18th, 1777, signed Benedict Arnold, Major General. Shameful forgery, but I think it's what you want. Here you are, Mr. Merrill.
Thank you, sir. I can't tell
Nonsense.
You...
Nonsense. Nonsense. Now, I suppose you want your orders. Well, here they are. All able-bodied scouts formerly under my command will go south. There won't be any fighting here for a while. Go south and report to General Washington. From what I hear, he needs every man he can get. He's a man you can be proud to fight with. Believe me. Now, as to you, Captain Merrill, I see you're wounded.
Oh, General.
Silence.
Only a scratch.
Silence. Computer Merrill, place you on the sick list. You're ordered to return to your home for a period of 3 months to recover your health. Counting on you, young lady, to see that he does it. So,
General.
General Arnold.
Oh, be off with you. Be off with you. My leg's playing the devil, maybe. You think all this talk has improved it? Or my temper? Or the state of the country? Be off with you, all of you. Goodbye, confound you. Goodbye. Send my orderly to me as you go. Go on, all of you. Get out. Get out.
That was the last time I ever saw him. The last time I heard his voice. That was many years ago. Of all that happened later, I know nothing. Or of the deed that caused him to be branded traitor, forever doomed to be cursed by the mass of his countrymen. But knowing Arnold and the sort of man he was, and the battles he planned, and his hold on the hearts of those who fought under him and beside him, I have this to say, and I say it gladly. Benedict Arnold was a great man, a great general, a great mariner, the most brilliant soldier of the Revolution. He was my chief in that war, and the bravest man I've ever known.
You have been listening to the Campbell Playhouse presentation of Rabble in Arms, starring Orson Welles and Francis Dee. In just a moment, Mr. Welles will return to our microphone, but first, right now, a word, if you please, to the mothers listening. Every mother knows that plenty of vegetables are a necessity for growing, active young people of all ages. And wise mothers are glad to know that in Campbell's Vegetable Soup, there are 15 different garden vegetables lavishly mingled in a stout, invigorating beef stock cooked just right for flavor and nutrition. Little wonder that mothers have come to regard this vegetable soup as almost a meal in itself. Always a comfort to mothers, too, is the way the youngsters take to Campbell's vegetable soup. Its very look is a bright invitation to the children to come on and eat. And because it's so delicious, they like to have it often. So I ask you mothers this. Do you keep Campbell's vegetable soup on your pantry shelf regularly? And now, here is Orson Welles.
And here, ladies and gentlemen, beside me at the microphone, is one of our favorites on the Campbell Playhouse. This evening's guest is Frances Dee.
Good evening.
Frances, I'm glad you kept your word of a few weeks ago. We're all glad you've managed to come back to us as soon as you have. Everybody who heard it, I know, remembers your fine performance as Lotta in Come and Get It.
You know, Orson, I wanted to tell you something about that. You remember you gave me that lovely triangle with which you called the men to dinner and Come and Get It?
I do indeed. Mr. Esmond, Mr. Harry Esmond, have you an equivalent to the lovely triangle? Sounds like a fire engine, but is that a reasonable facsimile? You said you wanted to use it, as I remember, to call your two boys to eat their
Campbell soup.
Thank you so much, Miss
Yes,
Dee.
And would you believe it? That triangle has disappeared. I think it was too fascinating for some
it.
Of the neighboring youngsters.
You were wondering? You were wondering.
I was wondering.
Go ahead and wonder.
I was wondering if there was anything on this broadcast you could give me to take its place.
Well, would they come if you played Yankee Doodle on a drum and fife?
Well, I'm afraid you don't know little boys, or maybe you do. The next time they'll want a symphony orchestra.
A small enough price, Frances, believe me, for a performance, and believe me, again, as entirely swell as yours was tonight. Thanks again, and come back again.
Thank you, Austin. I will.
Goodbye. Frances D., ladies and gentlemen, in her more serious moments, was Ellen Phipps. Pretty wonderful Ellen Phipps. And Captain Peter Merrill was pretty wonderfully played by Mr. George Koulouris. Edgar Berrier was Nathaniel Merrill. Captain Nason was Mr. Robert Warwick. Huff was Richard Baer. Guy Rep was Edward Donahue. Richard Wilson was Scout Fleck. And William Adeland was General Adlib. Madame Senage was Georgia Backus. And Benedict Arnold was your obedient servant. Music tonight was inspired by and was contemporary with the American Revolution. And was authentic, or so Mr. Bernard Herrmann claims, who conducted it, as always. And now, as to next week. Next week, we bring you our own radio version of one of the truest and finest plays yet written in America. Craig's Wife by George Kelly. A personal enthusiasm of mine, which I hope next Sunday we can persuade you to share. A Pulitzer Prize play, a study dramatic and penetrating of a type of woman, unfortunately...
Not as rare as she ought to be.
Not as rare as she ought to be. And a player, I'm pleased to announce, I was right, an actress whose talents are as rare as they come, another old friend of yours and one of the supremely gifted ladies of the theater world, Miss Faye Bainter. Miss Faye Bainter will be recalled by Campbell Playhouse listeners for her sensitive and searching portrait of Mrs. Dodsworth in our own recent broadcast of the Lewis novel. Moviegoers have seen her very lately in our town, the United Artists picture, and a newer picture is young Tom Edison and RKO's Bill of Divorcement, eagerly awaited. It's impossible to think of anybody better for Craig's Wife. In fact, it's almost impossible to think of anybody any better. And until then, until next Sunday night, my sponsors, the makers of Campbell Soups, and all of us remain, as always, obediently yours.
The makers of Campbell Soups join Orson Welles in inviting you to be with us in the Campbell Playhouse again next Sunday evening when we present Craig's Wife with Faye Bainter as our guest. In the meantime, if you've enjoyed tonight's Playhouse presentation, won't you tell your grocer so tomorrow
when you order Campbell's vegetable soup? This is Ernest Chappell saying thank you and good night. This is the Columbia Broadcasting System.